Here's what we got for you today. Did President Macron of France make a deal with President Trump that goes something like this? I will help you with Ukraine if you get Candace Owens to stop reporting on my wife being a man. This is an amazing story. Also this, there's a BBC report about Mariupol that is coming into question for its veracity. What does it say about the situation in Ukraine? And what does it say about the BBC? And then the former prime minister of Ukraine says that the U.S. is looking to dump and replace Volodymyr Zelensky. Nikolai Azarov joins me live for the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And we're beginning the show today with a story that has seemingly captivated the attention of people all over the world. But there's a man, there's a new and almost shocking development here. This is Candace Owens, as I have told you here in the past on this show about her and her show. She's made an investigation which has been seen by hundreds of millions of people all over the world. In it, she meticulously details how President Macron of France, when he was only about 15 years old, began dating his teacher, who at the time was almost 40 years old. That, in and of itself, is kind of weird. Potentially criminal, right? But wait, because this gets a lot weirder. Owens is reporting also details that that former teacher, currently his wife, Brigitte, was actually born a man. And that reporting, which Candace Owens stands by, she says 100%, and even now stakes her career on it, is linked today to the war in Ukraine. How? Well, because, stay with me here, because Candace Owens says she got a call from the White House, several actually, telling her that Macron would be willing to help Mr. Trump end the crisis in Ukraine if she, Candace Owens, stops reporting on his wife.
I received a very strange message from a friend of mine. I'm not going to identify that friend, but the message specifically read, "Hey, I have something to tell you from the White House. They asked me to call you. I'm just the messenger here." Again, strange. "I'm just the messenger here," like kind of removing themselves from whatever was going to be said. So I assume it's got to be something weird. And I say, "Yeah, whatever. Give me a call." And so he does call me pretty immediately, by the way. And he says, "Somebody very high up at the White House has asked me to ask you if, as a favor, you could stop speaking about Brigitte Macron." When I checked online, I realized that Emmanuel Macron is in Washington, D.C., February 24th. He is in Washington, D.C., and he had departed the White House just hours before I received the call. When I call that person back, they tell me something that is even stranger. They say, "Look, I am the messenger here. What I was told from somebody that's pretty high up at the White House is that Emmanuel Macron is holding up negotiations to end the Russian and Ukrainian war unless you stop speaking about his wife." And I'm just going, "What?"
Yeah, what? I agree. Owen says that she got a total of 3 calls from the White House, with the last one then coming, call number 4, by the way, from the president himself, who told her that this was a big deal to Macron. Owens, who I've met in Miami and found to be both strong-willed and a very principled woman, says that she told the president she simply didn't feel comfortable doing what he was asking her to do.
I said to Trump, and I will be honest, that at that moment I realized that one day this is going to go into my autobiography, and so I got to say something funny. And I said to him, "You know, respectfully, Mr. President, it's not my fault that he married someone with a penis." He then tells me, we're really close to getting this thing done. He tells me again, "Macron's been really good to me. You know, he's been very easy to work with us. He's been a good person. He just wants me to get this one thing done." And then he throws in the art of the deal type stuff. He starts complimenting me. He said, Melania loves you. She says, you're so beautiful. She thinks you're so beautiful. I said, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Mr. President. You know, compliments will get you everywhere in life is my mentality here. And then I say to him what I've agreed to already in the back of my head. I say, look, I'm happy to do this for the short term. Obviously, I don't want to have on my conscience that less Christian men could have died in the East if I just shut up about something. But I'm very clear to him that this is going to be short term.
You know, I have to ask, one has to ask after hearing that, is the war in Ukraine that trivial to the president of France that he's willing to use it as a bargaining chip over his wife's hurt feelings? It's an interesting question, isn't it? Also, do his actions, asking the president of the United States to intervene, make the reporting about his wife seem to you less likely or more likely to be true? You tell me. Of course, the French media, France 24, one of the channels that I've come to watch since I've been over here, is following these developments and at least presenting, of course, both sides of the story, right? They're going to tell you both sides of the story, right? Wrong.
Delving into the speculation and the rumors and the downright lies, Catalina Marchand-Desbrun by the Big Board. Good evening to you. Debunking claims that Brigitte Macron is transgender. It sounds ridiculous, but some people are saying it.
This type of disinformation continues to be a potent weapon against powerful women. Disinformation always pushed by the same group of people, conspiracy theorists and far-right groups that spread, let's call it what it is, transphobic rumors.
She's saying that if you believe that, you hate gays and you're a prejudiced human being. That's what they're doing. It's interesting, that kind of reporting. I know it well. That type of reporting, by the way, has become commonplace in the Western corporate and government-controlled media. They start with a conclusion rather than a question. In fact, yesterday, right here on this show, I heard Max Blumenthal, who was my interview, describe how the BBC works at the behest of the British government. I've got an example of what Max was talking about. Look at this BBC report on the city of Mariupol in Ukraine, captured by the Russian army. The BBC says, back then, by the way, when the war was at the very beginning, the BBC says 90% of that city that was all but destroyed 2 years ago is still destroyed from indiscriminate bombing that's continued and that Russia has done absolutely nothing to repair or help the residents there. Now, by the way, in that story, they also say where they got their information. They say they talked to, quote, a handful of people on the phone, most of which no longer live there. Okay, so let's try and break this down for you. Let me show you first the pictures of what it looked like back in 2022. It was horrible. This looks like Dresden in many ways. The city's clearly destroyed. It was. It was a horrible time in the war. Has anything changed since? Is the BBC's story true? Or is it reporting on the behalf of the British government, which despises Russia and wants people to think that Russia just left this looking just like this and has never gone in to try and fix it for the people who live there? Let's find out. RT correspondent Roman Kosarov is good enough to join us now. He's in Mariupol, the city of Donetsk's Republic. So the story, Roman, that the BBC is reporting, that the city is completely destroyed, 90% of it at least, is what they write. Is it true? What do you see?
Well, if we were back in 2022, that would have been the fact. I was here back in 2022, as well as other RT correspondents, not just from RT International, but other languages as well. And truly, the city was in dire straits. Most of the buildings here have been destroyed completely. But the BBC report from the 29th of June of this year is certainly a very far cry from the truth. I mean, I could take it and rip it up point by point, every point that they make. Well, one of them was the fact that there is no running water here in Mariupol, and Apparently, there is, and this wasn't turned on just for us here in Mariupol. Basically, I came here today to Mariupol to show you, Rick, and the rest of your fans and viewers what's it really like. The city is very clean. I know you mentioned it to the Russian representative at the UN, how you like Moscow, how everything is very clean, no homeless people. Well, the same thing here as well. There are trash cans absolutely everywhere. People don't throw trash around. And of course, the city is living. As for the destruction here in Mariupol, well, a lot of apartment buildings have been rebuilt. Some of them have been renovated. Well, entire neighborhoods have been built here in Mariupol, and I've visited all of them earlier today. Filmed them just for you. I'm hoping they're showing the footage right now.
Yeah,
here on the streets, you can see those kick-sharing scooters. I don't think that a city where the citizens' basic needs are not covered would introduce kick-sharing, scooter rental places in a city like this. And this is a city of at least 300,000 people, and more people are returning to Mariupol, every single month. Now, I was also at the beach a little bit earlier. Now, let's put on that footage, and I saw something absolutely amazing. I mean, people on the beach having a good time. There is a children's nautical club, so the kids are learning how to sail. I'm hoping that you're showing that right now. There are coaches. People are on the beach with dogs basically, the city is living. The city is absolutely fine, and probably one of the quietest cities in the next republic right now.
Hey, let me ask you a question, Roman. Because I'm a journalist and I have to ask you this question. Please don't take it personally. The only thing that you're showing us is the part that looks good. And you're not showing us the 90% that the BBC is totally destroyed. How's that?
I don't think we have enough time in this broadcast to show you the entire city, but I'm trying to make the best of this. I mean, take a look. The camera turn around. This is one of the streets here. You can see there are a lot of cars, which shows, yes, they do have petrol fuel.
Right.
I can see people walking around with their kids and absolutely carefree. This city hasn't seen any major fighting since 2022 when the city was liberated. Now, another point about the BBC, they said that the city was destroyed by Russia. But no, I talked to the locals here back in 2022, 23, and even today, and most of them are saying, no, Ukrainian forces, Azov Nazis, what they did was they used scorched earth tactics. In other words, they destroyed not only infrastructure, not only residential buildings, but they were basically shooting people on the streets back in 2022 as they were retreating from the Russian army. Now, I spoke to some of the youth here in Mariupol from a local university. I met them walking around in one of the parks, and I showed them the BBC article, and here are their thoughts about it. Take a listen.
Mariupol has changed quite dramatically. Our city is changing very quickly. Our infrastructure has improved greatly. A lot has appeared. New stores, parks, shopping centers are opening. In general, the city is developing. Many people from different cities of Russia are coming to us. Our life is getting better. When Russia came, more opportunities opened for us, including for the youth. Usually people who have never been here write about the bad situation in Mariupol. Usually local people are not asked, and experts who are far from our city are irritated by this.
They write bad things about our hometown. It's extremely unpleasant. How can you say such things when you see everything completely differently? When they describe unrealistic things, reaching the point of absurdity, saying that we have nothing, people are starving and living in fear, but I live here and see how people live. You understand that everything is much better than it was. In 2022, it was scary, of course, but now life is changing for the better every year.
In fact, such people with such criticism are called armchair experts because they do not see everything that we see here. Here are the houses built along Metallurgov Avenue. They say that it's 3D graphics, that the houses are made of cardboard. Well, there's nothing I can say about this. Good luck to them. It is a shame that people think so, especially people who lived here, studied here, and then left it, and now they are slandering us for staying in our hometown. However, I don't think that the majority thinks this way. Everyone will agree that we are much better off under Russia than we were under Ukraine. There were so many problems with electricity, water, money laundering, restoration of monuments. Let them tear them down in Ukraine, but here in Russia, it's all good.
Hey, Roman, let me ask you a question. You notice the way I rolled the R's in your name? That's because in my language, in Spanish, we roll R's too, by the way. Roman, I have to ask you a personal question because you're a journalist. I'm a journalist, right? And I get offended when I see people besmirch our profession. That BBC report, it's obviously a pack of lies. And it almost looks like it was intentionally written that way. How do you feel about that, about colleagues of yours and mine in the BBC writing a story that you just showed me is complete bullcrap?
I'm not sure how I feel about regular people like you and I, Rick, because I've been working here in Donbass since 2014, and I've seen all the atrocities committed by the Ukrainian military. And back then, so from 2014 until about 2018, we did have foreign media journalists here in Donbass, and they were covering. But then all of a sudden, they just disappeared, and they started making their materials from so far away, like this BBC piece. It was done by somebody who hasn't even been here. Yeah. And all of their people that were in the article, they're basically fake, which is, what we had was real people here in Mariupol, and actually people from BBC, CNN, Fox News, what have you, any Western media, they're always welcome here. But they decide not to show up. That's the way it is.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. It's the biggest sin of all in journalism. To make up information and to use sources that aren't qualified to be able to tell you what's actually happening. Thank you so much for actually showing us what it looks like as opposed to that story that we saw on the BBC. Roman, good job. Thank you, my friend, for that reporting. So, listen,
come on over here.
I will. I will. I promise to visit. When we come back, the former prime minister of Ukraine says that the U.S. has a plan to replace Zelensky. He wrote this. Again, former prime minister of Ukraine is saying this, and he's going to be joining us here in just a little bit to talk about this. Don't go away. And welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. I want to tell you about somebody who's the former prime minister of Ukraine. His name is Nikolai Azarov. And he has recently written something that I want to share with you. In fact, we're going to put it up on the screen so you can see it for yourself. Because when I saw this report, I immediately wanted to talk to him. And he's going to be good enough to join us here in just a little bit. But here's what he writes. He says, it seems that the decision to remove Zelensky from power, Volodymyr Zelensky, the man who was once elected, but not recently, the president of Ukraine, has already been taken in the United States. Washington has given the go-ahead. I don't think that Zelensky will stay in Ukraine after this. He will require security, most likely special forces. But such sacrifices will not be made for him. The options for his fate may be different. There is a whole lot to chew on there. The former prime minister of Ukraine is good enough to join us now live. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you, sir, for giving us your time. What did you mean when you wrote that? Take us through it.
Good afternoon. Well, first of all, I meant that if the American administration is really interested in restoring peace in Ukraine, then it must understand, and I believe it does understand, that Zelensky's regime is the main obstacle towards establishing peace. First of all, his term already expired, and now for more than a year, he is a legitimate, unlawful president of Ukraine. He is torpedoing, undermining all the peace talks with Russia about establishing even ceasefire, let alone long-term durable peace. And the American administration understands this, and the recent signals that were coming from there, for example, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau in Ukraine. Basically, it was established by the American administration in Ukraine. So now it's seriously looking into all the corruption cases of the people around, close the circle around Zelensky. It did not happen in the previous 6 years. So all those signals that are sent by the U.S. administration, these signals say that the decision was made that to achieve this, the regime must be changed. And regime in Ukraine, you know, it's a Nazi regime, basically. It's a punitive regime. There is no opposition parties in Ukraine, no opposition media in Ukraine. Thousands of people are in prisons. So to say that Americans are protecting democracy in Ukraine, to put it mildly, it would be wrong to say that. And there are other signals that are saying that Zelensky regime is going through dire straits currently because it was installed by the previous administration, by the Biden administration, and it is an anti-Trump regime.
Let me ask you a very direct question. And the question is the following. Can you hear me, sir? Let me ask you a very direct question because this is a very important issue. Have you or has someone in your camp, perhaps one of your advisors, spoken directly with anyone in Washington about this?
Well, you're asking a question that one cannot answer, must not answer, because certainly the conversations that took place, they must not be made public. The knowledge of this conversation must not be made public, because, as I said, opposition in Ukraine has been basically destroyed. So people are getting killed even abroad. Recently, for example, a former employee of the presidential administration, Andrei Portnov, was assassinated near the entrance to the school where he brought his children to in Spain. And I can go on and on with such examples. So let's not speak about these matters. It's a confidential matter, and okay, I'm not going to disclose my sources.
I understand, sir, and I respect that. One gets the sense that there has been some communication there, but we will leave it at that. Let me ask you about Zelensky. You probably knew the man. You probably heard him say that when he became president, he would make sure there was peace with Russia, or at least friendly relations with Russia. What happened?
What happened is the following. Of course, I used to know him as a performer. I met him at various events, so he was an entertainer there. And, of course, I could have never thought that a person like this with such a low level of preparation could take the leading roles in the country. And in June of the year, when he was elected as president, yes, this is true. Before that, he was saying that he's ready to establish peace, he's ready to come to terms with anyone. He said a lot of good things. That's why I believe he was elected, among other things. But that June, he received instructions from an organization called USAID. I believe Trump made a decision to eliminate this organization, if I'm not mistaken. In the instructions, in the guidelines he received, it contained a number of recommendations, and one of these recommendations said the following: no peace with Russia, no recognition for Donbass. You go on with the hostilities, you continue to fight to return Donbass and Crimea, eradicate Ukrainian Orthodox Church and destroy Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. I can go on and on, then follow the International Monetary Fund requirements and so on and so forth. After he familiarized himself with these documents, and it also contains certain red lines. It said, if you cross these red lines, you are not a president anymore. And I personally knew these negotiations tactics or these guidelines tactics. When we postponed the association agreement, European Union Association Agreement decision, we postponed this decision because it was not beneficial for us. It was in 2013, in November. And we suggested to the European Union to delay, to postpone the signing of this agreement. And then I had a phone conversation with Mr. Barroso, who was the head of the European Commission back then, and he literally told me the following: if you're not signing the agreement, another prime minister will sign it. And I can also recall my meeting with the deputy state secretary, Victoria Nuland, who was in charge of Ukraine back then. And during that meeting, she directly told me that we would like you to hire as a deputy prime minister Yatsenyuk and another person. And then I asked her politely, how is that your business, who is our deputy prime minister in our government? We have a constitution, and this constitution says that the deputy prime minister is elected by the parliament when I suggest candidate as a prime minister. So as long as I'm a prime minister, Yatsenyuk is not going to be deputy prime minister at my government. And these are just two examples that show, like in this case, an American high-level representative or a person from the European Union, basically making decisions for us, for an independent state, making decisions about documents must be signed, who should be hired as the deputy prime minister, and who is wrong candidate for this. But we were a truly sovereign state back then, and currently Ukraine is not a sovereign entity of international law. It's a puppet state. And this new administration, Trump's administration, gave us a hope that Trump is perfectly aware of the real situation in Ukraine, and he wants to have a peace deal. And he understands that it makes no sense. It's useless to speak about peace with the current government.
Let's talk about the current situation in Ukraine. And I take it you are a Ukrainian. I'm sure your heart is still in Ukraine in many ways. You understand the situation there now, and you probably talk to people in Ukraine, both common people on the streets, as well as people who are perhaps still affiliated with the government. What is the feeling in Ukraine right now about Zelensky, about this war, about their prospects for freedom, peace, etc.? Can you draw me that picture?
Of course, I closely follow all the developments in Ukraine, and I really like the piece about Mariupol that you've just shown, because for more than 10 years I lived in the Donetsk region, in Donetsk, and what I saw in this piece and this story shows that Mariupol is getting reborn, reconstructed. It was a large-scale industrial center, scientific center of Ukraine. And it was so nice to see it, this new rebuilt Mariupol. Now, coming back to your question. So, the subordinates of Zelensky, when they speak to the media, they say that his rating is very high among the population, but in reality, this is not true. He has no rating, and all those polls that are carried out under this regime, when you answer wrongly, you can be put behind bars, they do not reflect the real moods of the people. Yes, this is true. 24/7, there is this blatant propaganda zombifying propaganda, and it's depicting Zelensky as a savior of the country, a person who is very close, has very close personal relations with all the leaders in the world, and who is getting help from everyone. But what's happening in reality is different. Most people have negative attitude towards him. They hate him. They hate him for the sacrifice, for the losses that the Ukrainian people suffered. They hate him for the destruction of the industry. If we speak about the economy, two-thirds of the budget of the country is currently funded by the American money, EU money, and money from the other states. And they are transferring huge amounts of money to the Zelensky regime. And I can cite one number. President Trump also mentioned that, and we can cite other sources. Over the last 3 years, Kyiv regime received more than $350 billion. This is a huge amount of money. Just for you to imagine, before the coup d'etat, the budget of the country was approximately $70 billion. So over this time, the Kyiv regime received five annual budgets of Ukraine over these 3 years. And currently, the Ukrainian industry, the power generation reduced by 3 times, metallurgy reduced by 6 times. So industry is basically gone. And pensions, welfare is for the military, wages for the military, for the police officers, for the teachers. It is being paid from the money that is being transferred from the Western countries that are supporting, backing the Kyiv regime. If they stop this backing, then the Kyiv regime will go bankrupt. And the finance minister of Ukraine says that Ukraine currently cannot pay back the debt that they have. They will not have this chance to pay it back for the next 30 years. So basically, the country is bankrupt and on a number of obligations, so they have defaulted. And I can speak more and more about the need for peace. Ukraine needs this peace. They need time to recover, to restore their economy, to restore the industry, to restore those social guarantees that we used to have. And for this, the regime must be replaced.
If the regime is replaced, then what will we see in that country? How important is it for Ukraine to have sovereignty and to have perhaps decent relationships with France and the UK and Germany and Russia and China and the United States? Is that the kind of future you think would be best for Ukraine? Neutrality?
Of course, because the declaration of the state independence of Ukraine when Ukraine became independent, and after that, the constitution was drafted, and I was one of the draftees of the constitution. It says that Ukraine is an independent sovereign state that is non-aligned, not part of any blocs, and pursues independent, neutral policy. And our government always followed the principle that we must maintain good relations with our neighbors, for example, with Poland, with Russia, with Belarus, with Lithuania, with the other countries, with the Western countries as well, with those who want to cooperate with us, to work with us, to help us develop Ukraine. And always when we sent an ambassador to the United States, we instructed him that for us, the United States of America is a very important country from the standpoint of our development, because it has huge clout in the world, and we need to maintain at all times good neighborly relations with the United States. And I maintain the same position towards Russia. Russia is our natural partner. Russia represents for us a very good market for our commodities, for our materials. We know this country. We are familiar with this country. We know enterprises who might have bought our commodities or supplied their commodities to us. Our markets are very much alike, so it's only natural for us to have very good trade with Russia. And of course, we couldn't have allowed such a tragic mishap as stopping our gas transportation system. We had some 750 billion cubic meters of gas transported via our countries. 30% of European Union gas demands were covered by us. Since then, the European Union started receiving expensive gas, so almost 2.5 times the gas prices increased. So EU is suffering losses, but Ukraine is also suffering losses because now it does not receive any income from the transition of Russian gas to the European Union. And our policy was that, first of all, we need to take into consideration economic, political interests of Ukraine, and of course, we also took into consideration other countries' interests. We were a bridge between Europe and Russia, and it gave us a lot of benefits. And what you're saying about who is going to be there, what is going to happen, the most important thing now is to have an agreement between the leading powers of the world, the United States and the Russian Federation, from the standpoint of putting an end to the armed conflict in Ukraine. And for this, there must be a compromise about how this transition period is going to look like to bring back the constitutional order to Ukraine, to ensure law, to ensure independent justice in Ukraine, to restore independent media in Ukraine so that people can choose their own future by themselves. I believe all these things must be negotiated during the talks between the United States and the Russian Federation.
Let me ask you a tough question. And because I have had a lot of sources tell me that Ukraine is just an extremely corrupt country, that it was corrupt before, that it's even more corrupt now, and that it's just had a history of corruption there for some reason. Is that true? And I guess from a curiosity standpoint is, and by the way, I know all countries are corrupt. There's corruption everywhere. But they say that I have been told that Ukraine is a champion of corruption. Why? What is the history of corruption in Ukraine, and why is it so prevalent?
I would like you to understand the situation, how it was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Ukraine gained independence after that, and then reformations came, transformations came, and it led to the establishment of the so-called market economy. I cannot say that we managed to build perfectly functioning market economy because the so-called oligarchization happened because most industries were acquired by the oligarchs back in the 1990s. Then by the 2000s, this process of oligarchization of our most profitable enterprises, so this period was over. And we lost 65% of GDP. Two-thirds of our industry ceased to exist. A lot of our people lost jobs. And we had awful social crisis in the country. And in 2002, I was in the government, and I had to work hard to try to restore the economy. And as a result of this disparity in income, because a great number of people basically had very low salaries or very low pensions, and at the same time, there was this layer, this stratum of people who had colossal income. So that's why it brought about this awful corruption. We were trying to take serious measures, and we managed somehow to bring order into this. I cannot say that we managed to defeat corruption in the 2000s, but in comparison to what was before us, at least we brought some order into this to a certain extent. We carried out a number of activities. We were trying to increase the quality of life, to bridge this gap between the income level. And when people started getting good income, then corruption naturally went down. And what happened after the coup d'etat? Well, first of all, the Poroshenko regime, and I knew this person very well, the person that became president of Ukraine, he basically spearheaded the corruption at all levels himself. And Zelensky, when he came to power, I thought that being a new person in this environment, he will start fighting corruption, but that did not happen because all his entourage, all the people around him, they just took over from the Poroshenko administration, and then the corruption in Ukraine became even more flagrant. Well, of course, when we were at power, such things existed as well, but we were trying to counter corruption in some ways. And currently, there is no countering corruption anymore, because it's coming from the administration of Zelensky himself. It is being organized, it is being backed, and it helps all those people working around him to become richer. So, and these are not my estimates. These are estimates of the of experts who live in Ukraine and experts who live abroad. And they believe that Ukraine became the most corrupted country in the world. And I can say that it is possible to resolve this issue. We need fair, honest government, and then in a number of years we can, well, maybe not eradicate this problem completely, because you're right, there is corruption in all the countries of the world, well, to a different extent, of course, but still. But at least we can bring it back to a level that will be more or less normal.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you, sir, for sharing your very honest perspective on the situation now in Ukraine, and hopefully what you seem to be drawing as a picture for the future. We thank you very much here for taking time to talk to us today. Good luck to you, sir. And that's our news. And we want to thank you for taking time to spend some time with us. We try to keep it as real, as raw, and as honest, and as corporately untouched as possible. That's our goal. That's our mission. Remember to follow us on my podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking, or JSpeak. It's on YouTube. Go see if you can find it. Check it out. We do some different things there and some bonus episodes. Also, if you want to have a conversation, you can find me at Rick Sanchez TV. That's on X or Twitter. We'll be looking for you here again next time.